Today I would like to talk about borrowing God. You may wonder what the scripture reading, which Roman has to do with the borrowing God. You may be even wondering, what does it mean to borrow God? Well, I hope you will understand what I mean by that by the time we get to the end of the lesson today. But the sons of Sceva were trying to borrow God, or Jesus Christ in effect. They wanted to use Him for a while, to a limited degree, to cast out demons, but they did not fully want to own Jesus Christ. They did not want to become His disciples and submit to His ways and His laws. They just wanted to borrow or use some of His power for their purposes, their narrow purposes, for a while. In effect, then, they were borrowing God or Jesus. And they found out they couldn't do that. Let me start off then by observing, or proceed by observing, that borrowing is often not a good thing. I'm sure you're a nice person. All of us are pretty nice people, and we like to help people out, and we would even like to loan people things if they can use some of what we have in a situation where they're experiencing some need. So we will loan them things. But then on the other hand, how do you really feel about loaning things that you own in certain situations? Do you really feel comfortable about, for instance, somebody borrowing your car? How about a teenager borrowing your car? You feel comfortable about that? Oh, I have a license. I can drive. It's legal. But do you really feel comfortable about loaning your car to a teenager? Probably not. Or at least you would have some concern, wouldn't you? Borrowing is not something that is always good. And this is true from the standpoint of the one who loans, the lender, and also true from the standpoint of the borrower. Why is the lender concerned? Well, he's concerned that if he loans something out to someone, then it may not be returned to him. And even if it is returned to him, it may not be in the condition it was when he loaned it out. And then the borrower, on the other hand, well, he feels the burden, the anxiety of returning the borrowed item in good condition and in a timely fashion. Because, you know, we've heard a lot today about borrowing in our economy today. People borrowed money that apparently they really couldn't pay back, but the loans that were offered were so good that they just found it hard to resist. So they took out loans in order to mortgages on houses that they wanted, and borrowed money that they could not pay back, and they wound up in trouble. We hear about people borrowing with their credit cards quite a bit, and they mount up a pretty high debt, and they get themselves in economic trouble because of that. It reminds me of what is said in Proverbs 22, verse 7, where it says, the borrower becomes the lender's slave. You know, if you really get deeply into debt, sometimes you feel like you're just owned by the creditor, don't you? Well, even the Bible takes a dim view of borrowing. I won't take the time now to read all of these passages from the book of Deuteronomy, but the Jews in these passages were forbidden to loan their brethren any items at interest. They could not charge interest for any money that they loaned, for instance. Now, they could take pledges to ensure that they would get their items back. You let me have something you have, a common form of pledge would be somebody's cloak. And since a cloak was something that was needed overnight, if you took someone's cloak, which they would use to cover themselves up at night and stay warm. You ever spend a night freezing? That can be pretty uncomfortable. So if you take somebody's cloak, which they would basically use as a blanket at night, you pretty well guaranteed that by nightfall you were going to get back the item that you loaned out. So you could at least take a pledge, but you could not keep someone's cloak if you took that as a pledge overnight. You could not keep it overnight. You had to return it to him, to the one who had borrowed. And there was even a prohibition against taking the cloak of a widow at all as a pledge. Couldn't even take the cloak of a widow at all. So there were restrictions, even in the Bible, in the Old Testament, on borrowing. And when we come to the New Testament, we see that Paul said in Romans 13, verse 8, owe nothing to anyone. It's just not, if you can afford it, and I realize that with the way our economy is set up, it's very difficult to avoid all kinds of borrowing, especially with big ticket items like houses. But as much as possible, try to avoid borrowing. That seems to be the practical message of the Bible on this subject. So I'm just trying to make the point that, oftentimes borrowing is just not a good thing, either from the perspective of the lender or the borrower. But we might ask, if borrowing can be so bad, then why do people borrow? Well, let me give you a couple of reasons why people borrow. And this relates to the point that I'm going to make about people borrowing God. People borrow because they don't want to pay the price of full ownership. Why pay for something when you can borrow it? So these people want the benefits of ownership without having to part with all of the money required to buy what they can borrow. And so in some cases, borrowers impose on the goodness of owners who have made the sacrifices. The owners have to be the one to make the sacrifices, lay out the money to buy the item, and then here somebody comes along and borrows it from them because he does not want to lay out the money. He doesn't want to make the sacrifice of his wealth to buy that item. I'll have to confess to you, there have probably been times in my life when that would describe myself. I felt bad one time. This was years ago before I was living down in Georgia before we moved here. And I didn't have much of a yard, to tell you the truth. I mean, I didn't have much grass. The grass I had was kind of sparse, but every once in a while, what there was needed to be cut. And my lawnmower just was not working very well, if it was working at all. And so, you know, I'll have to admit, I didn't want to go out and spend money on a new lawnmower, so I went to my neighbor and borrowed his. And I remember one time the poor guy, when I went to him to ask if I could borrow his lawnmower to mow my grass, he hesitated and he said, I tell you what, Gary, let me get my old lawnmower for you. I think he knew I had rocks in my yard. So he didn't want to give me his nice lawnmower, so he gave me his... He was a nice guy, and I was not being such a nice guy. I'll have to admit, when I look back on it, I'm ashamed of myself for taking advantage of my neighbor like that. But that's the way people... That's why people borrow sometimes, because they just don't want to have to part with their money. They want the benefits of this item, but they don't want to have to buy it. But another reason people borrow is because they don't want to accept the responsibilities of full ownership. Even after you lay out money initially to purchase an item, there's going to be more expense. Let's use the example I was using a moment ago. A lawnmower. Okay, you buy a lawnmower to mow your grass, but is that all you have to do? No! Contrary to what, I don't want to make anybody feel bad here, but brethren, you know, the lawnmower has to be maintained. Every once in a while, the oil has to be changed. Blade has to be sharpened, you know, and on, you know. So there are maintenance costs. And items sometimes have to be stored. You have to spend your time and your energy fixing things up that you have bought or repairing them. So, there are responsibilities that go with ownership. But see, if you borrow something, you go borrow your neighbor's lawnmower, you don't have to worry about all those responsibilities. Let him change the oil. Let him sharpen the blade. Let him take it down for repair. You don't have to shoulder all of those responsibilities because you don't own the item. Yeah. Maintenance. Some people think they can avoid all of this by simply borrowing what they need, when they need it, from the owners themselves, and let those owners bear the cost of ownership. So this is the basic benefit of borrowing. The idea behind borrowing is that when a person has finished using a certain item that he has borrowed, then he can retain it. He doesn't want to keep it. He doesn't want the responsibilities that come with ownership. So he just returns it when he's through. All he wants it to do with the item that he has borrowed is use it for a relatively little while to serve his own very narrow purposes. And then he wants to return it to the owner so that he can avoid the fuller array of responsibilities of ownership. Well, as strange as it might sound, people also like to borrow God. That is to say, they don't want to own God fully. They would just like to use Him for a little while. Just use Him for a little while. For brief periods. Once in a while. For their own purposes. You see, owning God outright would impose responsibilities and duties upon them that they don't want to bear. You see, they want God for the benefits that He can bring to them, but they don't want to be saddled with what? What's this about obedience? You mean if I own God fully, I would have to obey Him? Oh, I just want to borrow Him once in a while. I don't want to own Him. You know, we use the term, it may sound strange to speak of owning God, but sometimes we use the word own to mean to acknowledge. He owned up to the truth, we sometimes say. So to own can mean to acknowledge. To own can mean to accept responsibility. A person owns up to his responsibility. That is, he accepts responsibility for what he has done or for himself. And this definition of own fits what is meant when we say a person is said to own God. As a matter of fact, Jerry, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this to you. You probably know the song. You might want to lead it later on. We sing a song commonly. I'm not ashamed to own my Lord. Well, what does that mean when we say, own my Lord? To be associated with Him, to identify myself with Him, to be His disciple. Like I said, the sons of Sceva there in Acts the 19th chapter, they just wanted to borrow Jesus for a while. They would have been ashamed to own Him as Lord. They just wanted to use Him for their own narrow purposes, for their own convenience. They just wanted to borrow God. And that's the way people are. They just want to keep it nice and convenient, not fully own God, just borrow Him once in a while. Okay. More specifically now, let's think about ways in which people borrow God. How do people borrow God? And I'd like to mention to you now four ways in which people borrow God. Perhaps you could think of others, but these are four that I've come up with anyway. First of all, they borrow God by believing in an afterlife or heaven. Now, people can hardly stand the thought that this life is the entirety of their existence. That if they died, that would be the end of them. That this life is all there is to their existence. They want to believe that death is not the end of everything for them. They want desperately to believe that they and their loved ones will somehow continue in some way to live on after death. They want to believe that they can rejoin their loved ones beyond the grave. Well, what do people do about that? You see, when people start thinking in those terms, they ordinarily may not be religious. They may not care a thing about God otherwise. But then when they're faced with death, and we all get faced with death periodically, don't we? They're forced into a situation where they have to think about the afterlife. Or what happens to a person when he dies. And when they start doing that, they start thinking about God, because God is the only one who can control something like that. So then they start to bring God into the picture. But what are they doing? They're just borrowing God for a little while to deal with the problems opposed by death. Otherwise, they never think about God. Otherwise, God is out of mind as well as out of sight until the time comes when they want to start speaking in heavenly terms or talking about God or making some sort of allusions to God, direct or indirect, when they're faced with death. It's amazing to me to listen to people who, if they're not atheists, they're agnostics. They're just not sure, that is, what to think about God. But then, I've listened to people talk about such people, atheists or agnostics. They begin to talk about their loved ones or their friends who have passed on. And all of a sudden, these people who may be scientists, secularists, naturalists, that is, all they believe in is what they can see or the natural world, all of a sudden they start talking in terms that sound so very unscientific for them. They start saying, well, maybe so-and-so. And I remember one time there was this, he's died too now, but there was this well-known, I'm not sure exactly what scientific discipline he was involved in, Gould. I can't even remember his first or second name, but his last name was Gould. And you probably heard of Carl Sagan. Well, Carl Sagan, his friend, preceded him in death. And I was listening to him Gould being interviewed one time, the scientist being interviewed, and he said something to the effect, maybe Carl is out there somewhere looking down on us. He found it impossible, apparently, to get away from the idea that, you know, somehow Carl Sagan, his beloved friend, must still be out there somewhere. Must still be existing. He just couldn't bring himself to believe that Carl had died and he was as dead as Rover, dead all over, that is. But here's a second way in which people borrow God. When they talk about moral values, perhaps most people just assume that everybody's going to grant that there is such a thing as some absolute moral standard. Oh, people talk about moral relativism as though there is no absolute moral standard, that morals can change from situation to situation depending upon the kind of circumstances you find yourself in. So what may be right in one situation may be wrong in another, and vice versa. Morality is relative to the situation. So moral relativism. There are no absolute moral standards. It is something right or something wrong all the time. It always depends for such people. Until you talk about certain subjects. You think murder is always wrong? How about slavery? You think slavery is wrong? Or would you accept slavery in some instances? How about pedophilia, child molestation? You think that would be okay in some instances? What if it were your child or your nephew or your niece being molested? Is that okay? In some instances, would that be okay? Well, no, they don't want to accept that. Now, generally, people don't reason their way through this like this. They don't consciously reason. They just talk as if they assume, and the person, people to whom they're speaking, everybody assumes that certain things are wrong. But then if you challenge them and ask them, well, now, wait just a minute. Now, you talk about right and wrong. What is your standard of right and wrong here? You got to have a standard of right and wrong. How can you know what's right and what's wrong without a standard? They just kind of take it for granted. Well, let's not let them take it for granted. Let's challenge them. Tell me something that is genocide always wrong? Is what Hitler did wrong? Is what Stalin did wrong, for instance? Is what Pol Pot over there in Cambodia? Is what they did wrong in killing millions upon millions of people? Is that wrong? Now, how do you know that's wrong? So maybe they will struggle to come up with an answer to that. Well, if you hurt people, that's when it becomes wrong. Well, wait just a minute. You're assuming what is to be true. Okay? First of all, you tell me, how do you know that it's wrong to hurt people? Because it's just wrong to hurt people. Well, now you tell me why it's wrong to hurt people. Leave God out of the picture and tell me why it's wrong to hurt people. Why is it wrong to kill 10 or 20 million people? Because it's wrong to hurt people. Well, now you're not answering the question. Why is it wrong to hurt people? Well, see, they don't have an answer. They've never really been challenged by like that in most instances. They're really kind of self-righteous and hypocritical about it because they don't want to allow you your moral scruples, but they want their moral scruples. For instance, let me give you a contemporary example. Homosexuals cannot marry one another. You can't. It's wrong for you to deny them their right to happiness. They want to be married. Two men want to be married to one another. Two women want to be married to one another. It's wrong for you to deny them their right to be together as a married couple and enjoy their happiness. That's wrong. I think it's wrong for them to be married to one another, for them to be committing these acts of homosexuality. Oh, you're a bigot. You got a problem. How do you know? By what standard are you judging me? They might say, well, by what standard are you judging homosexuals? You have no right to judge homosexuals. Well, the Bible says, the Bible, I don't believe in the Bible as a moral standard. Okay, then by what standard do you say that it's wrong for me to condemn homosexuals then? You see? They're holding me to a standard. But they don't want to be held to a standard. You see, they're really hypocritical. They're inconsistent. They draw lines, right and wrong, between right and wrong. But they don't want me drawing lines on the basis of what the Bible says. Reminds me of a professor I had one time. Anthropology professor. And I've been told that anthropology professors are some of the most liberal professors there are. And she happened to be a female. And she was asking one time, what is the meaning of anthropology? And anthropology happens to come from a couple of Greek words, and I'd taken some Greek, so I knew what it meant. The etymology of the word. And I said, well, it means actually the study of man. Oh, she didn't like that. You said man. Isn't it narrow? She corrected me. Study of humans. Don't narrow it down to male humans, men. It's the study of humans. She corrected me in class one time. I slipped up later on, and in writing, I put down, anthropology is the study of man. She corrected it on paper. Study of humans. You see, that is what they call anthropocentrism. Anthropocentrism, is a big sin in anthropology circles because anthropocentrism means that you're using your culture to judge someone else's culture. You can't do that. You know, those headhunters over in the Philippines, they may go around cutting people's heads off, but that's part of their culture. You should only try to understand them. You should not condemn them. Otherwise, you're being anthropocentric. You're judging them from the standpoint of your culture. Well, excuse me, but I grew up in a culture where you make distinctions between men and women. And she's judging my culture. You see? That's the way these liberals work. They're hypocrites. I've said for a long time, scratch a liberal and you'll find a hypocrite. No, people, they want to talk, they only want to borrow God once in a while, and they don't even want to acknowledge where they're getting their moral values. But they just want to borrow God once in a while to talk about right and wrong. Their right and wrong, their version of right and wrong. And then when they're through talking about their version of right and wrong, they'll put God on the shelf again. And they won't even call Him God. Now, that's the way they are. Well, to borrow morality, that is to borrow what inherently belongs to God without acknowledging God is moral plagiarism. That's what it is. You know what plagiarism is? That's copying somebody else's work. And in academic circles, it's a very big problem. If you get caught plagiarizing in school, particularly in college, oh, you're in big trouble. You may not only just flunk the course, you may be kicked out of school if you get caught plagiarizing. That is a big, big no. But people plagiarize God all the time. God, folks, has the copyright. He holds the patent on morality. And what people do is they steal the copyright, or at least they plagiarize from God without acknowledging their source of morality. And that's hypocritical. Let me move on to a third way in which people borrow God. They borrow God by obtaining help in times of need, or protection so they won't be in trouble or need. They borrow God for security purposes. Now, since people don't have absolute control over the world, and since we cannot, foresee all of the events, all of the forces that may hurt us in this life, and what do we do? What do people in general do? They turn to God for help in those circumstances. When they're not in trouble, God is out of sight and out of mind, so to speak. But then when they get in trouble, then they start borrowing God. Otherwise, they couldn't care anything for Him. Reminds me of a story, I may have told it before from this pulpit, or maybe from a lectern when I was teaching a class, of a movie in which Burt Reynolds was the central character. And he thought he was leading a miserable life, and he had decided to kill himself, if I remember the plot of the movie. And he was going to kill himself by drowning. And he went down to the beach and he swam off into the ocean. If you saw this movie, you're probably going to correct me somewhat afterwards, because I may be corrupting it or embellishing it. But my memory is, anyway, he swam off into the ocean in the attempt to drown himself. Well, when he got out there into deep water, he started to change his mind. And he started asking God for help. Help me to get back to shore. I'm tired. I don't want to kill myself after all. Help me to swim back. And so he starts trying to make his way back to the safety of the shore. And initially, when he decides to ask God for help, he makes all sorts of bargains with God. I'm going to make this big sacrifice. I'll give up this and this and this and this if you'll just save me and help me get back to shore. And so he starts swimming back to shore. And funny thing happens. As he gets close to shore, and the possibility of him drowning decreases, and the possibility of him making it back to shore safely increases, then the things he's willing to sacrifice fall by the wayside one by one. And he gets closer and closer, until finally when he's just about back to shore, he's not willing to give up anything. What's he been doing? What do people like him do? They just borrow God in times of need. Oh, they don't want to keep them. They don't want to keep them for that long. Just use them for a little while until the need passes, and then they can give them back. They really don't want to own God. Reminds me of Pharaoh when he was enduring those plagues back in the book of Exodus. You probably remember, all the plague would come down upon him and his country, and he'd call in Moses and Aaron, and he says, I have sinned. But then what happened when he was relieved of the plague? He had a change of heart, didn't he? You see, he just wanted to borrow God until he could get rid of the devastating effects of that particular plague. And then he would revert to what he was. He did that again and again and again. And I'm reminded of what Jesus said about the people who had been, the thousands of people who had been fed miraculously by Him with the multiplication of the food. He said, you sought me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate bread and were filled. What was His point? His point is, you're just using me. You think I'm a walking grocery store, and that's all you want for. You don't want to use this as a sign to come to believe in me and become my disciple, my full-time disciple. You just want me so you can fill your stomachs with food. You just want to borrow me for that purpose. Finally, people want to borrow God sometimes just to give some purpose and some meaning to life. Now, no one likes to think that his life is without purpose or meaning. Oh, you may think that you know some people. I'm tempted to think this myself. That you know some people who exhibit utterly no sense of direction or purpose in their life whatsoever. They just live from day to day. I would encourage you to look more closely at their lives. I think they really do have a purpose. It's just not evident to you. If you look at their lives, you may find something that they're interested in. It may be nothing more than the desire to live from one day to the next that keeps them going. That's their purpose in life, but they have a purpose. Now, people's purposes may stretch all the way from something very selfish, like just bringing as much pleasure as they can to their lives, to something very noble, like, you know, healing the sick or feeding the hungry, you know, something like that. But people have purposes to their lives, and as a matter of fact, people feel this need for a purpose, a meaning to their lives so keenly that even if they do not acknowledge God, they will create a purpose for their lives. It may be golfing. Their purpose in life may be to be the best golfer in their golfing group, their golfing club or whatever. Their purpose may be their favorite football team or baseball team. That's what they... Oh, and they will devote their lives... They will buy clothing that has the name of their favorite team on it or their favorite player on it. They will buy all sorts of sports paraphernalia. They will spend a lot of money to go to the games. That becomes their focus, their purpose in life. You said people do have purposes. They may not be very worthwhile. They may be shallow purposes, but they still give themselves purposes in life, something to live for. What are they doing? In effect, they're borrowing God, or they're putting God substitutes in there. Something to give a purpose, something to give direction to their lives. And when they do that, they create what has been called, and I didn't invent this phrase, but they create what has been called the noble lie. The noble lie. What is the lie? The lie is that, for atheists anyway, is their life, that their lives have purpose, have meaning. When really without God, there is no purpose, there is no meaning to life. It's utterly meaningless without God. So the atheists, but you may say, I know atheists, and they're very charitable, they're altruistic, they make all sorts of wonderful humanitarian efforts. I would have to ask, why? If you're an atheist, why are you doing it? Why are you wasting your time working for others if you're an atheist? It just makes no sense. I mean, an atheist working for humanitarian purposes is like, it makes about as much sense as a turtle in the fast lane. It just makes no sense. Why do that? I mean, listen. For the atheist, I mean, even if he helps somebody, oh, I saved the life of someone, I feel so wonderful, I gave my life purpose because I fed this person and extended his life. You know what's going to happen? That person's going to live a little bit longer, and then he's going to die. That's what's going to happen. The humanitarian is going to die, and the people he helps are going to die too. So I have to ask them, what's in the long run, what's the point in helping people? You're just extending their lives by a little bit more. Now, I don't mean to sound like I'm opposed to humanitarianism. No, the point I'm really trying to make is that if you don't acknowledge God in your life, your life is ultimately, ultimately meaningless. There is no purpose for it. Now, if you don't, if you cannot appreciate that, think for just a moment. If there is no God, where are you going? What is your direction in life? And when you get there, what have you really accomplished, ultimately? If people are going to die anyway. I mean, if you become a physician, a doctor, or a scientist, and you discover some cure for cancer or something like that, even if you find a cure for cancer, the people who are cured from cancer, they're going to die anyway. Ultimately, you may extend their lives for a while, but they're going to die anyway. So what is your purpose in life? But listen, if you can teach someone the gospel of Jesus Christ, and you can, through doing that, help them to live forever in bliss in the presence of God, that, then, you have accomplished something. But see, atheists have convinced themselves that God is not a good idea. We want Him out of our lives. Well, if you kick God out, then you kick out your reason for existing. But they try to create purposes for their lives. And this self-created purpose could lead to a life which is very hurtful to others. And it would, well, but it wouldn't matter if their purpose was to hurt others and to derive pleasure by hurting others, because, well, as we've already discussed, there's no moral standard for them to say that hurting others would wrong. But see, the people they hurt, they have no purpose or meaning to their lives either, so it doesn't matter if you hurt them then, does it? See, that's the problem with atheism. In fact, what would you say would be a wonderful existence or experience for you? I think most people would say, you know what? If I could absolutely not only eliminate suffering from my life, but could eliminate any possibility of ever having to suffer, then that would be wonderful, wouldn't it? I mean, we all suffer, don't we? From time to time, whether emotionally, psychologically, or physically, we suffer. When's the last time you felt you suffered? You could probably, well, I suffered when I got out of bed this morning because I didn't want to get up. I suffered yesterday. I had a flat tire. Whether we're talking about big sufferings or small sufferings, we all suffer. One way or the other, quite frequently. What if I told you there's a way that you can eliminate even the possibility of suffering? Well, you could euthanize yourself. That's a nice way of saying you could commit suicide in the best way possible. You might say, well, I don't want to commit suicide because that's a sin. That's a good answer. That's a great answer. It would be wrong. That's God's prerogative to take my life and not mine to take it. But you see, if you're an atheist, you can't say that because that would be inconsistent, wouldn't it? So what would the atheist say? What kind of answer can he give for why he doesn't place himself in a position where he won't have to suffer anymore? Now, let me ask you this. How much suffering did you experience before you were born? You didn't suffer anything? You didn't suffer with George Washington's troops through that terrible winter down in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania? You mean you didn't get shot in the Civil War? Or World War I or World War II? You didn't get your arm blown off in Vietnam? You weren't killed in a traffic accident? No, I didn't exist then. You mean you didn't suffer at all before you were born? We would say that's a pretty good state. Well, you could return to it by killing yourself. That is, from the perspective of someone who does not believe in God. You can return to that same state. Well, then why don't you do it? That's another one of the inconsistencies of atheists. They can't even give a reason to themselves or others why they should even continue going on and living. So, under an atheistic arrangement or regime, in which falsehood can be as valuable as truth, evil as good as virtue, selfishness as good as selflessness, and non-existence actually better than existence, under that kind of arrangement, an atheistic arrangement, then life is not only pointless, life is absolutely absurd. We should not even be living. But people don't want to admit that. So what do? In one form or another, they borrow God. Is it any wonder then that people want to borrow God? Well, this morning, I want you, if you're borrowing God, quit borrowing God and just buy Him entirely, own Him entirely by becoming a disciple of Jesus Christ. Quit the borrowing. You can't borrow God. Really, you can't borrow God. You can't just bring Him in for your own purposes once in a while and then return Him. You can't. It doesn't work that way. Buy God fully. Become His disciple. We invite you to come forward in faith and in repentance to confess your belief in Jesus Christ as the Son of God and be baptized into Him that you might own Jesus Christ, own God, instead of just borrowing them every once in a while. And if you have done that at some point in the past, but you've gotten back into a rut again so that in effect, even though you might call yourself a Christian, what you're really doing is just once in a while borrowing God, I hope you understand it can't be like that. It's all or nothing. You've got to own God or reject Him altogether. You just can't borrow Him once in a while. If you wish to come forward this morning and confess either your faith in Christ or your sins, whatever your particular need might be, we ask you to come now and do so as together we stand and sing.